to the Hour of Lateral Thinking, heard weekly from New York City. I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. Lateral thinking is sideways thinking. It unspools the mind.
It's not necessarily logical.
Its conclusions, if any, are unforeseen. As always, we will be joined by Chris Cerf, co-author with Henry Beard of Spenglish and Encyclopedia Paranoica, and on his own, A Skunk in My Bunk, compulsive writer and songsmith David Finkel, Maggie Paley, author of More Than Just the Book of the Penis, and audio engineer and musical perpetrator Bob Auld to discuss comic books. Well, who knew back in the days of having your dad take you for an egg cream and a look at the comic books at the Sylvan Luncheonette that comic books would assume such grandiosity as they have since, even to be called graphic novels. It was unthinkable. When I was a little kid, comic books were like for illiterates or something. Although, David, you say you have a, you had a, there, it was a, there was something more positive about it.
Did I? Well,
I think
yes,
you did.
I'm sure. I don't know who you were talking to exactly, but anybody can answer then. All right, then. Let's see. What was that thing you said? Anywho, I believe comic books, as we learned today in Wikipedia, were intended for children and the lower class. Now, by that, they must mean people who don't even speak the language, because at least they can see the pictures and get an. And in fact, you can learn the language by seeing the attitudes that the characters in a cartoon are displaying, I would believe. And I don't believe that the lower class is less intelligent than any other class. I don't
better
like
not.
Class. Class kick, dismissed.
We'll kick you right out of here.
Yeah.
I believe that. But, you know, now that I think of it, it's just occurring to me now, there was a comic strip called, I think it was the Cats and Jammer Kids.
Yes.
Hans und Fritz.
Yeah.
And they were a kind of, they were sort of designed for immigrants to be amusing and to understand, to have a little bit of their own language in the strip. I don't remember any other accented comic strip. Chris, do you have a first impression of the comic strip or a comic book?
Well, I always loved them, and my parents were great about it. My dad felt it was getting me to read something,
right,
and he encouraged it, just like the Hardy Boys or For Girls Nancy Drew, he felt that way about that.
Right.
I do remember, speaking of whether comic books were meant to be classy or not, there used to be a comic book series called Classics Illustrated.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, which were novels that were turned into short comic books. And I think those were meant to be a transition from bad comic books to good books. And so in school, I was encouraged to read those, but we always liked DC Comics better. Marvel was only just coming into its own as I was reaching my teens, but that became the comic book to have as I was getting older.
Now, DC Comics, I guess, were a big turning point for everybody, for the modern culture, really, because those are the ones that kids read, and a House Un-American Committee type investigations were made of these. They were a lot of more horror comics.
Well, that was EC
Comics. Oh, EC.
Yeah.
That was DC.
DC was Superman and Batman.
Oh, okay. EC was a great one.
Yeah, that's. I think they turned into Mad Magazine, too.
That's right, they did.
Yeah, Harvey...
Kurtzman.
Kurtzman was there.
Mad and Panic, and they had a whole series of them. Yeah. Well, we'll leave lots of time for those great comic books. But David Finkel, you have a first impression of comic books? You probably didn't have a little candy store luncheonettes where you could get an egg.
Oh, yes, I did.
Oh, you did. Good.
We had the San Hicken, which was at the beginning of San Hicken Drive. And when you walked in, it was rather narrow. It was long and narrow. When you walked in, the soda counter was about 10 feet in front of you. To the left were the magazines and comic books.
Right.
And, you know, we had comic books and comic strips. You know, there were the funny papers, which had comic strips, and not all of them were turned into comic books. But in those days, I was a bit of a little thief when I was a kid. And we would come in, my cousin Danny and I, and we'd go to the left, and we'd pick up a big magazine, and then we would put a comic book inside it, which is smaller, and then we'd close the big magazine, and we'd pay for the one. And so we'd get our comic.
The perfect crime.
It was a perfect crime. We were never caught. But what I used to read in those days was Little Lulu.
Yay!
Yeah.
And Nancy and Sluggo.
Yay! Oh gosh, Nancy and Sluggo.
Which was written by Ernie Bushmiller.
Yes.
And it was Nancy who had the aunt Fritzy Witz, didn't she?
That's yes, right.
Fritzy Witz, yeah.
And Phil Fumble, Aunt Fritzy's boyfriend.
I don't remember him.
I don't either.
To remember his last name meant that you were a real strong devotee of Nancy and Sluggo. Wait a minute. Little Lulu. Oh, she had the mop.
That was Mr. and Mrs. Moppet.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. But Aunt Fritzy Ritz was quite glamorous, actually.
And Aunt Fritzy Ritz got a spin-off comic strip.
I could be wrong, David. I think she might have been the original comic. I think Nancy might be a spinoff of that.
You may be right about that, Chris. I might not, but that's what I recall.
And she had this chubby little niece and her chubby little friend. Her chubby niece Nancy, and chubbier, her bald and chubby best friend. Yeah,
they were up to no good most of the time.
Really?
But they were good kids. But they fooled around. And then I graduated. I mean, there were others as well. But then I graduated. I'm sure all of us did, to Mad Magazine.
So fast? What happened in the middle there?
Nothing really. Suddenly there was Mad Magazine and
Little
Alfred
Iodine.
E9.
Little Iodine fit in there.
Oh, I never read Little Iodine.
Wasn't she part of another comic?
She was probably another.
Popeye. That was all.
She had a sort of imitation of Little Lulu, but her name was spelt Lil, L'IL, Little Iodine. And
little like Baby Snooks.
And she had kind of curlicue hair, whereas Nancy was like a kind of black Christmas tree with a bow on it. And little Lulu had a little hat. Lulu had a little tiny, adorable, really hat. And she had curls, corkscrew curls. And she was a feminist from the start. She would crash the boys'.
No girls allowed at the clubhouse.
But I think now we're talking about them in the 40s. So they came after, in a way, Orphan Annie, which was in the 30s.
That's right.
Started in the 30s.
Little Orphan Annie was a biggie in the 30s.
So right. I came after Orphan Annie in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew about her, but I didn't. I was really very partial.
She was still going.
She was still going, of course.
It's still going.
And do you remember Henry?
Of course.
He was bald too, wasn't he?
He was bald too, and he had the strangest shaped head. It was shaped like a peanut or a bean or something. It was big.
Who was Henry?
Didn't he have one hair coming out of his head?
Yeah, he had one hair.
Yeah.
Who was Henry?
Yeah.
A cartoon comic strip.
It was called Henry?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, they had Alley-Oop, they could have Henry. I mean, they tended to have simple names for these characters.
How about Prince Valiant? He had a nice haircut.
Oh, he was in the funny papers. I guess there was a Prince Valiant.
Oh, sure.
But he was in Sunday comics.
Dick Tracy, all of those. And Nancy was in his Sunday comics, too. I don't think Little Lulu was. I think Little Lulu was just the book, you know.
But these
were very easy. The illustrations were very, very simple. A very small child could learn to read from them and learn to play pranks on little boys. I will say that Little Lulu was probably the first feminist I ever encountered. Maggie, do you remember that?
No.
Okay.
I don't remember very much about comics when I was a kid. I remembered after you and I talked, Janet, I remembered Archie and Veronica and Betty.
I loved them.
Yeah, but I think I was more interested in girl comics, girls because, I mean, Nancy.
Did you like Katie Keene?
Katie Keene, yeah.
No, I don't remember Katie Keene particularly, but Little Lulu and Archie and Veronica and Betty. That was a big deal for me. That was because Veronica and Betty were always fighting with each other.
And they were like identical twins. Because
they looked exactly like
one was a blonde. No, one had dark hair.
One was blonde and one had black hair.
Yeah, right.
Betty, and Betty was blonde.
Who was the boyfriend? It was Joe.
Reggie.
Yeah. Was, yeah.
And he was kind of upper class and annoying.
Yeah, he had slick back black hair.
That's right.
And what high school did they go to? They were always in
Riverdale.
High They went to Riverdale.
Riverdale High School.
Riverdale High School.
That's Mr.
Right.
Weatherby and Ms. Grundy was the teacher.
That's right.
One day, Ms. Grundy announced to the class that the sun, our sun, is going to burn out in the sky in 14 million years. And Jughead goes, What? What did you just say? And she says, the sun's going to burn out in 14 million years. He said, oh, my God, I thought you said 9 million.
Anyway, not a bad show.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And Jughead often was so bleary-eyed. He looked like the first drug taker of high school students. And yeah, he would have little plus signs instead of open eyes. Do you remember that? And a hat, strange hat.
He loved hamburgers, much like other cartoon characters, like Wimpy.
I didn't think Jughead could come up with a joke as good as 9 million years. I mean, he was called Jughead.
Yeah, well, that was his ears, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. When did Peanuts start? I forget when. '50s or the '60s?
Oh, that was much later.
'50s. Well, let's just
was
kind
it
of
the '50s or the '60s.
Let's kind of summarize 60s. these '40s, because they would have had, you know, a certain type of influence, although they had some kind of social significance and so forth. They weren't nakedly apparent to the 6 or 10 year old kid who was reading them, and yet they were everywhere. I remember a radio show, as a matter of fact, called The Comic Weekly Man. Does anybody remember it?
Mm-hmm.
No.
I'm the Comic Weekly Man. Your weekly Comic Weekly Man. I'm here to read the funnies to you. Happy boys and honeys. And then he would read, unfortunately, from the paper we weren't allowed to get, the Journal American. It had all the great ones. It had Dick Tracy and it had great ones. It had really good action ones. And Blondie, I think, Blondie and her husband was like Jughead.
Dagwood,
who had these very gigantic sandwiches. And he was
I think we have to be specific that Little Abner was by Al Capp, and Dick Tracy was within Little Abner, if I remember correctly.
Was he?
I don't think so.
It seems to me that...
No, it was Keane. Bob Keane, or Bob, I think, was the guy who drew Dick Tracy. I think. And it had the Crime Stoppers textbook. Do you remember that? There was a little notebook up in the upper right-hand corner of Dick Tracy with two little holes drawn like a loose-leaf book, and it had a tip for stopping crime every week.
This was very useful.
Could you tell us an example? Do you remember an example of stopping crime?
It was things like lock your door at night. Yeah. It was at that level.
Anyway, this is all newspaper comics, but there was also cartoons and films, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, those were very Bugs Bunny and that sort of thing.
And one of the earliest sound cartoons and films was Popeye.
Really? Well, let's hear it for him.
Yeah, so this is a musical cue, folks. Here we go.
Okay.
He's Popeye the Sailor Man.
Oh, my hero.
He's Popeye the Sailor Man.
Oh, I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, 'cause I eat me spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
He's Popeye the Sailor Man. He's Popeye the Sailor Man. He's strong to the finish, 'cause he eats his spinach. He's Popeye the Sailor Man.
I'm one tough gazooka Stead hates a palooka. Stead ain't on the up and square. Biffs him and buffs him and always out roughs him, and none of them gets nowhere. If anyone dares to risk me fisk, it's Buffin, it's Wham understands. So keep good behavior, that's your one lifesaver with Popeye the Sailor Man.
He's Popeye the Sailor Man. He's Popeye the Sailor.
Chicken of the sea, yeah.
He's strong to the fish, cause he eats his spinach. He's Popeye the Sailor Man.
Is that a little character too, a wimpy type character? That was Robin Williams, we think, singing the theme song from the film, the Robert Altman film, Popeye. And I thought I heard a little olive oil in there. It sounded like she was in The Shining.
She's in there. Yeah. There was a reference to Joe Palooka in there, which is another cartoon, Palooka.
Oh, yeah. Palookaville.
Yeah.
By the way, I looked it up while we were playing the music. Uh-huh. Chester Gould was the guy who did Dick Tracy. And he was famous for drawing little arrows pointing at things with labels on them, which are still known as Chester Gould arrows.
And what Al Capp did was he did a send-up of Dick Tracy called Fearless Fosdick.
Oh, that's right.
That's where I got confused.
Now, Al Capp was interesting because as we moved into the 50s, I think comic books took on a more political tone, you know? They weren't just pure comics for children. They had a message. And Al Capp, I don't know if he was once a kind of liberal cartoonist. Does anyone remember the earlier ones?
Al Capp was very far to the right.
Very far right.
Yeah. That's right.
The opposite of Walt Kelly, who was
Pogo.
Pogo.
Well, he was a genius, Walt Kelly.
A genius. And he came in books, and Pogo was in comic books and real books, paperbacks. I guess they never made a film about Pogo. Why not?
Well,
I don't know that they didn't. Maybe they did at some point.
I was trying to remember
what kind of a creature was Pogo? He wasn't a human, was he?
I think he was a possum.
Possum. He's adorable, really. Very cute. A very cute farm animal. Were there any farm animal characters in Lil Abner? Because that was kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies without the money, wasn't it?
Didn't they have the schmooze? Did Al Capp put the schmooze?
Yes, he did do one great thing.
Oh, right.
So that, in fact, when our friend Chris Surf, David Dozer, and my friend Jack Winter, when he was given an opportunity to give his sister a middle name, it was Shmoo. Helena Shmoo.
The Shmoos were so popular that they were manufactured, and you could buy a Shmoo.
Right.
And so I got a Shmoo at my 5 and 10. I needed to have a Shmoo. There was no question of that.
You didn't steal it, did you?
No.
Wow,
I paid for most things.
Was a Shmoo a little white blob?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Very, very cute, though. And how did it fit into Lil Abner? Did it, or was it a separate cartoon?
Oh, I don't remember the introduction of the Shmoos.
Chris, do you remember it?
I think it was all part of the same story. I think they were just... They appeared as a group, as I recall.
Because Al Capp lived, Lil Abner lived in a dog patch.
Right.
And maybe they showed up in dog patch. I don't know.
What a great art form. You have to.
I remember them being kind of northerly them. And being so friendly that they would offer to be eaten.
Well, I couldn't.
Shmoo?
The Shmoo I got was plastic, so I couldn't eat it.
Right. Couldn't it be squeezed? It was a squeezy toy?
There might have been versions of it that were squeezies, but the ones I got were plastic, and you couldn't really squeeze them.
I think I had an inflatable one.
A big one,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can take anywhere.
Well, not that big, but big that enough. Big enough to sit in the corner of my room.
Shmoo doll. And I think you bought them at bookstores, at the counter of bookstores, didn't you? know where they belong? Who knows? They didn't sell them along with the comic books, though. Now, what I was... Did anybody remember this? Because it has to do with the comic book, the slam down on comic books. And I think EC, the early Mad, was part of it. Does anyone remember Mad Comics before it became Mad?
Yes, well, that was the EC.
Comics.
That was
when
the
it was
EC.
A regular comic book.
It was a comic book before it was a magazine.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you remember when it was one cover of it was like a notebook, which so you could take it into school?
Yes,
and
I
wouldn't notice.
Absolutely.
Was that black and white thing? Black and
that's
white.
When it became a magazine by then. Yeah.
Sort of. And then, but also it had a comic book called Panic.
Yes.
Anybody remember that Panic magazine?
Yes, I do.
And Cracked.
And
it
Cracked, that's
cracked
right.
Cracked and Panic and Mad, yeah.
And they were all drawn by the same fantastic collection of artists.
Oh, there we go. I got to know Harvey Kurtzman later on.
As a person?
Much later on, as a person.
And as
a very nice person. And of course, a wonderful illustrator. And if you remember in the inside back page, you'd see a scene, and it would be a very interesting scene. But there were places where dotted lines, and if you folded the dotted lines in a certain way, it would narrow and make an entirely different scene that was a comment on the larger scene. Nobody remembers that.
I couldn't wait
to do that every month. And I wait. Danny and I would hang out at the San Hicken just waiting for the Mad magazine to come in.
The thing about Mad is that I remember I would read parodies in Mad before I knew about the original.
Right.
So often you would discover 10 years later, oh my gosh, that was a parody of Charles Dickens or something. You didn't even know. You didn't even know at the time.
Well, they did marvelous parodies of movies. I remember they lampooned an action film called Where Eagles Dare that the original starred Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood.
Right.
And it was totally far-fetched. And so they just made it a little bit more far-fetched. And it was hilarious.
It was hilarious. I remember the Julius Caesar one with right after Marlon Brando's Julius Caesar came out. They had on the road to Rome, they had little Burma shave signs. as Mark Antony or somebody walked towards Rome. And it said on it as he proceeded, "Be a noble, not a knave. Caesar uses Burma shave."
That's wonderful that you remember that.
It is amazing. Well, my best friend Sheila's brother was an avid collector. As he turned out to be a lifelong collector, and finally made his living really on some of these what were then really graphic literature, I guess you'd call it, on paper. And I remember his very, very neatly kept stack of first Mads and then Panic, and then when the magazine came in, it was not quite the same. It wasn't quite as subterranean and rebellious, but kids, and we must have been what, 10, 11, 12 years old at the time that, you might be a little younger or older, but at a very young age, we were being treated to very highfalutin satire of the culture.
Well, they had brilliant people, as you said earlier. Jack Javis, who did a lot of their covers, became a commercial artist all over.
Just
he did
so
TV Guide covers, and we even did things for us at Sesame Street.
Really?
I was thrilled to work with some of those people. And remember John Martin, Mad's maddest artist, they called him, who drew really insane-looking cartoons.
Part, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what did he? What was his specialty?
John Martin, you mean?
Yeah,
or Jack Chandler?
Yeah.
He did really insane kind of... wild drawings. He was their wildest.
Yeah, wild.
But he didn't do parodies. He did little comic strips within Mad.
And Wallace Wood, does anyone remember?
Yes, Wally Wood, you bet.
Another great one. I think he was the one that did Miss Potsgold.
It
was a satire of the Miss Rheingold beauties, which always ran in the subway. These are the ugliest, the most revolting-looking characters you ever, with noses that, splayed out into the road, and just horrible. And Potsreeby.
Patrizzini, yes. I always said.
How did you say it?
I said Patrizzini, but Patrizzini. I could have been wrong. Could be wrong.
No, it was Patrizzini, I think.
It was P-O-T-R-Z-E-B-I-E, I think.
It was hard to pronounce.
Well, that was the point. And axolotl. Yes. Remember, axolotl was another word they used all the time.
Which one?
Yes. Is a kind of lizard.
It might be time for another comic book character song. Before we continue and delve deeply into our satirical memory. Okay, this is The Who. As simple as a comic strip.
The original minimalism.
No mention even of Robin. Now, was Batman, was he a predecessor or a post, an imitator of Superman?
No, but Superman was from outer space, see. Bruce Wayne is immortal, living on
this
earth.
But they were both from DC Comics.
Yeah.
They were the same.
But which came first? I would think it was Superman.
I think you're right.
More fantastical background and everything.
Yeah.
And didn't the guy who did the original Superman, didn't he never get the rewards he should
have? That's right.
Remember, will you tell that story, Chris?
I can't remember his name, which I should.
Yeah,
but he actually did it as a work for hire.
Yeah.
He should have been rewarded somehow, but maybe eventually I think he got something late in his life, but the copyright belonged to the company and they never paid him anything except for what he got for writing the stories, which seems usually unfair since it became a TV series and a series of hit movies and all those things.
And everything.
According to Wikipedia.
Did he draw the Superman figure?
The character was created by writer Jerry Siegel and artist Joe Shuster.
Right, that's right.
And first appeared in Action Comics number 1, June 1938.
Yep.
So was Batman an Action Comics guy too, or was he?
I believe so.
DC or EC? What was EC?
That was Bob Kane, I think, was the guy, True Batman. But I think that was Action Comics or Detective Comics, but it was part of the DC company eventually.
Now, why am I confusing EC with DC? It was rather easy.
Because they're two separate companies. One begins with G and one begins with E. But you know what, Janet? You're right in that they both end with C. You got me there.
So Batman was first created by artist Bob Kane and writer Bill Finger and appeared in Detective Comics in 1939.
Detective Comics,
the year after Superman.
The year after Superman.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, how many times did Superman change his outfit, the design of his outfit and his hairdo?
No,
it may have been refined over the years. Yeah. I don't know.
It was never really changed. It's pretty much what it always was. Yeah.
Well, the big S was always certainly the same. And
remember, he always ran into phone booths to change. Yeah. I don't know where he would go now. There are no more phone booths.
That's right. He'd be stuck. He'd have a cell phone.
Didn't it always strike you as incredible that Lois Lane never figured it out? I mean,
yeah,
she loved Superman and thought Clark Kent was ridiculous, but never had a clue that it was exactly the same person who would go into a phone booth and come out as the other one.
I think in the movie she figured it out.
Yeah, finally. But she was a genius reporter, but she never got that story out.
Yeah, great reporter who couldn't figure out the simplest mystery that all of us knew.
And well, Superman in the 60s became a Broadway musical. And I think Lois Lane, sung by Linda Lavin, may have figured it out in that plot, that script as well. And it was called "It's a Plane, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman." That was the Broadway musical. Mm. And we've had other Broadway musicals made from comic strips: Little Abner, Annie, Peanuts, which was written by which was made into an off-Broadway musical. Yeah. By a guy named Clark Gessner.
Clark Gessner was one of the original Sesame Street writers as well.
Clark Gessner was a terrific writer.
Well, he was a Peanuts guy too, if he was a Sesame Street.
And he died, but Clark died young, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yes, he did.
Now
he had a disability, I think, which helped lead to that. He had some disease. He was on crutches for many years. As you might
remember. I think that's true. Probably not at the point when Peanuts opened off Broadway, but shortly thereafter.
And Peanuts was, I think You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown was the name of the musical.
Yeah.
And Joe Raposo worked on the music for that.
Oh, so he graduated
Sesame Street as well. Huh. And Pat Birch was the choreographer.
Oh, really? Huh?
Great things on.
And then there was a sequel. I can't remember the name of it, but I think Snoopy might have been the title.
Snoopy.
And the songs were by Larry Grossman and Hal Hackaday.
Well, now Peanuts was another one of these extremely artfully conceived things where there were so few words and so much emotion, I think, in these little characters.
So much adult psychology. It was really based in a way on the way adults think.
Mm. And he also, Schultz was brilliant at creating sub-characters and subplots, like Snoopy and the Red Baron, or Lucy and the football, all those things that are just part of the culture now.
Now, was Peanuts originally a monthly comic book, or was it always a strip?
I think it was a comic strip in the papers.
Yeah, that was the art of it, that it was for only five little boxes, and yet if you followed it daily and weekly, I guess.
But he eventually did lots of books and all.
Yeah, there were books about it too. I remember The Gospel According to Peanuts.
Right.
And I guess in his own way, Jules Pfeiffer had although it was for an older, seemingly older receiver or audience, a very simple, graphic, highly graphic, very little word stuff. Although when they did talk, it was a big balloon of words. I guess that's what defined the comics. It was the very first comic, all the dialogue in a balloon with a little or a thought bubble. Were there ever cartoons that didn't have them?
Well, I guess that must have evolved over time, but I don't know who first did the speech balloons. Would be interesting to know.
In those elaborate Tales from the Crypt comics, and those were DC, weren't they?
Oh yes, the
horror comics.
Yes, that was Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear.
Aha! I didn't know what you were seriously reading.
Yes, that's what I was reading. Yeah.
And of course, there was the editorial cartoon. They weren't really strips usually, although there might be in a cartoon that had
Herblock.
Scenes. Yeah, Herblock was the great one.
He had his big books of them. Who else? Well, how about Laurie Anderson in that game? What did she talk about?
Oh, Superman. Oh, John.
That was very arty.
Yes.
It sounded like she was under the influence of kryptonite, doesn't it?
Laurie Anderson. Right. Kryptonite production. You want to say what kryptonite is for anyone who might have missed this long saga of Superman?
Was it a metal or a rock that would affect Superman? It was from his own planet,
Krypton.
It acted like the gravity of his planet or something.
It was the
like
one
that.
Thing. It was the one thing that could hurt him.
Yeah.
And
right.
One of the things I always loved about Superman, speaking of kryptonite, as they evolved it into the comic books, was that whenever they made a mistake, people would write letters in catching them, and rather than admitting the mistake, they would add to the legend. Like, for example, Superman would walk by red kryptonite in some story, and it wouldn't affect him by mistake. And then they would say, well, if the kryptonite is red, it doesn't affect him. So that became, and then they would change the legend as a result. So red kryptonite was okay. And I always loved that column, that letters column, because it became a big joke to fans.
Right,
trying to catch them out and see what excuse they would give. They also created something called imaginary novels. In an imaginary novel, they could have Superman die or things happen that didn't really happen, so that didn't affect the mythology, which was a very clever literary idea. Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant. It means it had everyone writing and rewriting, adding on to the story. Yeah.
And of course, Marvel took that, Stan Lee took that even further.
Yeah.
With the Marvel universe.
Stan Lee, wow, yeah. Now,
genius as well.
Really geniuses, these people, aren't they? So, I mean, this idea of the graphic novel, or calling it a graphic novel, should have come a lot earlier.
Well, those were really books at first. Graphic novels were full-length, hardcover, in many cases, publications that were stories in themselves.
But, and who were the first graphic novelists? Was it Art Spiegelman, or was
he was the one that certainly, probably he wasn't the first, but that's who made them famous and respectable.
Art Spiegelman,
they were so
was
great, really.
Certainly one of the best, and still remains. Art Spiegelman's Mouse, M-A-U-S,
yes,
which was about the Holocaust,
right,
in which the Jews were mice, is really, great. Talk about brilliant comic strip.
And Ben Catcher, who I think, these guys were all together writing comics, C-O-M-I-X. David, talk a little bit, Dozer, about comics, because that was a whole hippie thing in San Francisco, where suddenly there was all
psychedelic
kinds of
beautifully comic books.
Yes, psychedelic, yeah.
Frank
Crum.
Yeah, Art Crum and a guy who put out something called The Adventures of Jesus was considered one of the first underground comics.
Very, very good character.
Art Crum and Mr. Natural and psychedelic characters. I don't know. I thought it was brilliant stuff. And you couldn't get it at the newsstand. You had to go to specialty stores like head shops and record stores already carrying them. And then you could get a subscription to some of these far-out comics. But they weren't on the... You couldn't get Little Lulu right next to it, or Archie. It didn't happen.
And what was that? That was a publishing reason, wasn't it?
I don't know. Was it?
I remember Head Comics.
That they had more liberty, that the authors and illustrators of those comics had more latitude in being vulgar, having... I mean, look at Art Crumb's women.
I remember Head Comics. They had him stopping at a roadside called Piss and Eat.
Wonderful.
I'm not sure if this has happened in English, but in France, there's a detective story writer named Leo Mallet, M-A-L-E-T, who's extremely good, and he's a follower later than Simenon. And a lot of his stories have been turned into comic strip books, and that are wonderful to read.
If you can
read it in French. But so I don't know whether we've had that here, where novels have been turned into comic. Well, certainly the classic comics. I suppose we could somewhere is Wuthering Heights in as a comic strip.
did Nancy Drew ever have a comic strip?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I'm not aware of it.
Or what was that other the thing for boys?
The Hardy Boys. I read every single one of them. But
did they have comics?
I never saw it. They had TV shows.
That's right.
In fact, Nancy Drew had a TV show quite recently, and Supergirl also is a TV show now.
Supergirl. Yeah.
I don't think we should. We shouldn't get to the end of this without mentioning Wonder Woman.
I was just thinking of Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Yes.
So true.
Yes.
Although she changed herself physically, I think. She was a little more voluptuous in her original days, as I remember it. Am I right or wrong?
Well, she's pretty attractive now.
New hairdo, all that in later life.
I remember about her was that there was something on her wrists that she could repel everything with something on her wrists.
They were bracelets. Yeah,
bracelets. Right.
They were made of some kind of metal, and she had a robot plane. Remember, and a lasso. She had a lasso that she could lasso people with, and she had a plane. an invisible plane that she could get through a pier somehow.
She was tough, wasn't she? And she had a belt that was like waist cincher. Maybe that was it. The size of her waist might have changed with the fashion. And her bosom.
And that was a TV show in the 60s or 70s also, with Linda Carter, remember?
Right. So, yes. So the guys must have been quite taken by Wonder Woman, little boys, right?
I loved it. Yeah.
Linda Carter was thought of as the most beautiful woman in the world at that point, wasn't she? Frequently, that's how she was described. Maybe I'm making that up. I don't know.
She was pretty beautiful.
Because she was playing Wonder Woman or was
probably part of it.
It was Wonder Woman who was the most beautiful woman in the world.
Right, that's what
I Linda
think.
Carter happened to look like her. So
remember, Wonder Woman comics had all kinds of references that, as a boy, I didn't get. Like they would say things like Suffering Sappho and things like that all the time. And that went right by me, of course.
Suffering Sappho, imagine that. I'm wondering, none of us got it.
I'm wondering if it's still going right by me, but maybe not. But we shouldn't forget Alison. More recently, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, which was about her.
Her father, the artist.
Was autobiographical. Well, her father ran a funeral home, and the kids referred to it as Fun Home.
Right.
And it was turned into a pretty good musical a few years ago. And
if you like that kind of thing.
And also, we should mention Roz Chast.
Oh yeah.
And a couple of years ago, she put out a comic strip version, I think, of her life with her parents.
I can't
remember the title of it now. I should be able to, but Roz Chast is New York. She's one of the current greats.
The greatest.
She's in the New Yorker.
Yeah,
almost pretty much every week.
It's not quite the same thing as a comic book, but it's as good as it gets.
No, she uses comic book techniques.
She uses techniques. Yeah, she does that kind of lettering and all of that. And did we say anything about before we summarize the whole comic strip experience? Say anything about the great Ben Catcher, who did a play also based on his drawings of the carbon copy buildings? And did the great, Julius Knippel, real estate photographer? Nobody knows these? Check him out. He's really great. And I mean, he does, I think his newest one is Dairy Restaurants of New York. I mean, and it's very scholarly. Every knish and every bowl of sour cream from every dairy restaurant on Second Avenue is in there and beyond. But in the meantime, let's have one of those heartwarming early comic strips turned into a musical comedy, thank goodness, so we can pay an homage to Little Orphan Annie. This is Little Orphan Annie singing the hit song from Annie.
The sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin. Tomorrow, I love you. Tomorrow, you're always
I have to say that one makes me cry under the current circumstances, and there isn't even we don't even have a Daddy Warbucks around, or not yet. What makes a little girl such an appealing cartoon character? Most of them, if they haven't been superheroes or super heroines, have really been little girls. And that includes Lucy. Is there any psychological reason for that? Silence.
I'm not sure, but it sure
thinkers, yeah.
It certainly has set off a series of Broadway musicals about little girls. Wicked and Cinderella was recently a musical, and it.
And then there are movies like Mulan as well, Disney movies.
Yes, Disney movies.
Which was originally
Little Mermaid. Yeah.
Mulan was originally a cartoon, and now it's coming out as a live action.
A wonderful movie with a terrible sequel. I don't know if you ever saw it. Mulan 2 is.
Is that out now?
No, it was a cartoon that they did because the first one was so good. And that it's amazingly bad. I recommend it for that reason.
We should probably say that the song Tomorrow was written by Charles Strauss and Martin Charnon.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably one of the last big hit standard songs that came from a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's right.
Still works,
can thank,
doesn't it?
Can thank Annie for that. There was an Annie, too, also.
Wasn't Tom, which, Tom Meehan was the writer, I think, of the play. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Tom Meehan wrote the script, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think then doctored by Mike Nichols, I believe.
He wrote?
Yeah.
He was a director and a producer.
Well, he was called
he
in
probably
as a director.
Worked on the script a bit.
I'm sure he worked on the script.
He tended to do that on a lot of his work.
Yeah.
To good effect, mostly.
Well, yes. His ship never went down, did it, in his entire life? Did it? I don't think so. Did he ever have a flop?
No, but then he died. No.
Well, that indicates a flop, right?
That is a dramatic. That's a dramatic sinking.
That's a Donald Trumper, right. I think. That
I don't know. Sometimes death is a great career move.
That's true.
Well, did anyone here ever attempt to do their own comic book series? I know somebody.
Oh, that's a good question.
I know.
I wonder if I have even thought about it.
David Dozer did one.
Yeah. What did I do?
Well,
I can't barely remember them. But I used to draw cartoons.
During the comics, IX period, you were doing various comics. And then there was Zim and Zam.
Oh, yeah. I had these two geometrical shapes that were pals together. And I forget what they did. And I presented this whole collection to the New Yorker. And they were much nicer to me when I was 18 or 19. They said, oh, you write pretty well, but my cartooning, goodbye. Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
I just thought
I spent a whole year on those, too, anyway.
Did Zim and Zam talk to each other?
They did, yeah.
They were kind of like Beckett characters.
They were too much like Beckett characters,
that was the problem. They weren't that funny.
I love to do stuff that's usually funny and make it as unfunny as possible just to be funny about it, you know? But some people don't get that far into it. Like, this is unfunny on purpose, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. Think that's funny? No.
I wonder if Samuel Beckett would have gotten upset if anybody had turned Waiting for Godot into
You're not going to believe this, but Henry Beard and I did it. We did Godot Action Comics in the National Lampoon. It had these incredible action-style drawings where absolutely nothing was happening. But anyway, I'll leave you with that. Godot Action Comics.
Couldn't be more perfect.
Yeah, I bet you can find it online.
Yeah,
I think it's there.
That sounds great.
Couldn't be more perfect.
I'm
going to
look it up.
You've been listening to The Hour of Lateral Thinking. On this show, you heard us with Chris Cerf, David Finkel, and Maggie Paley discuss comic books.
This program originates from 5 neighborhoods in New York City.
In one of them, our audio engineer and musical perpetrator is Bob Auld, with special thanks to Popeye, Batman, Superman, and Little Orphan Annie. You can email us at catradiocafe@gmail.com. I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright.
This has been a production of Cat Radio Cafe.
The feline's favorite radio empire.
And remember our slogan.
Cats don't laugh at comic books because cats don't laugh.